call the Senate Tax Committee to order. Welcome, members. Senator Nino is here. Senator Nino? Senate File 905. Welcome to the Tax Committee, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we have to wait until after somebody moves the bill, or at some point there's an A2 amendment, Senator Chamberlain said he'd be kind enough to offer to sync up the language with what the House has done, and also to restrict the, or to limit the bill a little bit.
Let's pass the A2 amendment out. This is your first stop, Senator.
Yes.
Senator Chamberlain moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment's adopted. Bill in the shape you want it, Senator Nino.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. And I'll explain. The A2 amendment is mostly technical, but the larger crux of that was to limit the scope it down to National Guard or Reserve members. Mr. Chair, this proposal came about as a result of a constituent who is in, I believe, Isanti County. This particular gentleman served six-month tours in Afghanistan and I think also Iraq. In his particular case, what happened is, in the midst of all of that, he was in very active duty, Mr. Chair. He helped with the medevacs, and going in under fire, trying to save young men and women's lives, and fighting the good fight. And in the midst of that, somehow, I don't know the story of how it happened, he failed to make the property tax payments on his home. Ultimately, when he got back, got everything in order, what happened is the fines and penalties on his property taxes that he'd forgotten to pay were more than the property taxes. And most people, this isn't going to really be a concern for, because it's usually an escrow activity. It's part of your mortgage, and it's all going to be taken care of automatically. In his case, he had no mortgage. He does now, because he had to take out a loan in order to pay his fines and penalties and taxes. And he came to his legislators and said he had no problem paying his taxes. He knew that he owed his taxes. But in his circumstances, we had a gentleman literally putting his life on the line, trying to save the lives of our soldiers, and getting penalized as a result, simply because in the midst of all of that craziness for six tours, he forgot to pay his property taxes. This bill simply would allow someone in that circumstance, if that happens again to somebody else, they would have to pay their property taxes, but the fines and the late fees and the penalties, the interest, would be waived. That is what this bill does, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Senator Nino.
Thank you.
As we were looking through these yesterday, one of the issues that has come up is there's a timing issue, in that the individual wouldn't get the county wouldn't know that the individual was on active duty till they pay their taxes, which is the time they would notify them of that. But the taxes would be due 6 months prior to that. So they would end up going into delinquency, having the publication occur, and then would get the relief. Is that kind of the mechanism?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I had a conversation with a department staff yesterday, and that is a little bit of a catch. We couldn't think of any real simple fix for that. So if this legislation were to be enacted, that little problem still would exist, as it does today. But they ultimately would, in the end, be able to get the fines and penalties and interest waived. So it would make things a little bit better, but not perfect. That is true, Mr. Chair.
And, Senator, you know, what if we were to just grant the local authority the ability or the requirement to abate these taxes for active duty servicemen? Would that accomplish your goal? They would have to go through the publication then?
You don't want them not to pay, do you?
No, that's right. No, we don't want that. No. Well, let's work on it, because it seems to me that we want to resolve that publication issue. I don't think we want these folks having their names and delinquent status published for 6 months.
Mr. Chair, if the committee or if staff or in with my participation, I would help in any way I can, could find a solution to that, I would love to do that. The issue came to light yesterday afternoon. I had a conversation at 3 o'clock, and just really quickly, we could not find a simple fix that didn't also create some fair amount of burden on the local governments as well, or incentivizing all members to simply delay their taxes because they could. So at a really quick glance, we couldn't find a simple fix between yesterday and right now, Mr. Chair, but I would love to be able to do that.
Senator Rest.
Well, it seems to me there could be some sort of, so that everybody just didn't do it when they did remember, there could be some sort of affidavit that, would be something that you could attest to that you did indeed forget or something. And then it seems to me that the taxpayer soldier, even if there was a delinquency mentioned, that you'd want the reversal of the delinquency to be public. So that it would not or to find a way to not have it, not so much the publication of it, but not affect their credit rating. And that's what I would be concerned about, that, showing that kind of delinquency is going to have an impact on their credit rating, and that somehow that could be expunged. And that might be, okay, so it, rather than saying, finding a way of not to publish it, find a way of expunging it in an official manner so that a soldier taxpayer could, inform the credit rating agencies that they were in good standing and so forth. Some kind of fix like that maybe wouldn't be quite as complicated as not publishing, because you wouldn't know.
Sure.
I think, Senator Nienau, you've got a good idea here. We're going to need to figure this out. Is there anybody from the local governments or the department that want to testify on Senate File 905? Ms. Von Bosch.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Susan Von Mosch from the Department of Revenue. Representatives from our department did meet with Senator Nienau yesterday, and we feel like there is a way for someone who is impending, has an impending tour, that there would be ways that they could notify their local county assessor, county property tax officials of their leave and some of these issues, and that this is something that we could work out with Senator Nienau and with you in terms of drafting language that would give us a way to deal with the issue in advance. It would require a little bit of work of the military person in advance before they do leave, and so it's kind of a trade-off on, do they want to do some of that work beforehand or have their name published in the paper afterwards, and so it would be that type of a trade-off.
Senator Rest.
Well, there are, Mr. Chairman, Senator Nienau, there are, service centers for families of soldiers across the state, and it would seem to me that kind of that those centers and the Department of Revenue could work together. The ideal thing would be that they didn't forget because they remembered and they actually paid it on time, unless there was a hardship. That might be a better approach, but it would take some effort on the part of Revenue to make sure that there was timely reminders for anyone who's going to be either on active duty within the United States or abroad. Either way, I think we need to fix it. Senator Scoy.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? Seeing none, I'd encourage you to work with the department senator and any of the committee members who show interest, see if we can figure this out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Anything we will indeed continue to meet and work on that and hopefully find a good solution. It just wasn't really easy to do between 3 o'clock yesterday and today.
Thank you. Will they send a file 905 over for possible inclusion? Senate file number 905 as amended will be laid over. And members, a quorum is present. Senator Gazelka.
Did we vote on that?
Yes.
Before we had a quorum?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members.
Morning, Senator.
Senate file 441 is fairly simple. The goal of this legislation is to make the late penalty for paying property taxes the same for homestead and non-homestead. Right now, if it's non-homestead or commercial, it's basically double what it is for homestead. If I can just give you a quick story, about 6 years ago, my oldest daughter graduated from college down in Oklahoma. I drove back and thought I'd be back in time to pay my property taxes. And I got back to Brainerd about 5:30 and went into the courthouse, and lo and behold, it was closed. I thought, well, that's no problem. I'll just get there tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. and pay my property taxes on my commercial building. And I walked in there at 8 a.m. the next morning, and they said, oh, you've got to pay another, it was somewhere between $400 and $500 more because I was 30 minutes late. And I couldn't believe it. At the time, I think I'd been out of the house. I wasn't in session, and I didn't realize then what I know now. About roughly a year ago, I talked to a county assessor in Morrison County, Russ Nygren, who I had hoped was going to be here. But he said, did you know that if you have a commercial building, you have to pay twice as much if you're late on your property taxes? Well, then the light came on to me because I thought, well, that happened to me. And I didn't realize I had to pay double as well. And so he was the one that really got me going on this and suggested that we change that so that the penalty is simply the same. If you're late, you're late. But instead of a 2% penalty if you're 30 minutes late, or instead of a 4% penalty if you're 30 minutes late, it goes down to 2%. So that's how this came about. I just feel like if you're a small business owner, those are the ones that are particularly the ones that are going to miss this one, because they're not, you know, it's not like they're keeping track of every report that they have to do and every thing that they have to do for the government. And I'm just saying, I think we ought to make it the same, whether it's homestead or non-homestead.
Good question.
Senator Est.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Gazelka, is the penalty for commercial industrial property a cost of doing business?
Senator,
is it deductible?
Mr. Senator Chair, Gazelka. Senator Rust, could you repeat that?
I don't believe that the penalties that homeowners pay is a deductible expense on their schedule, whatever it is, Schedule A. Is the penalty for late payment of commercial industrial property taxes a cost of doing business? Is it deductible or is it not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest,
Senator Gazelka.
I believe I gave that to my own accountant to take as a deduction, but you know, to be honest, I don't know 100% for sure.
I wonder if Mr. Silver knows.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I don't know for sure. I can look into that, but I'm not sure if it is deductible.
Is there someone from the department that knows? I think that might be a distinction. I'm not arguing with the premise of your bill, but I want to know how penalties are treated, if they're treated differently by individual homeowners as opposed to business owners or corporations or whatever.
Yeah, and while they're coming up too, Mr. Chair, keep in mind that if you have a commercial building, you are already paying 1.5 to 2 times more in taxes than you would a residence, plus above that another 30% that goes directly to the state. And then when we penalize them double it's on a much higher tax as well.
Senator Zelka.
I get the argument. I just want to know how it's treated and how it may be treated. I don't see anybody coming forward. But
Senator Est, the department was saying they shook their head. They didn't know the answer, but we'll see if we can get that answer.
Okay, good.
Mr. Chair, if they don't know, I think we should take that as a deduction.
Well, I'm going to speculate that they do, but we'll find out.
We'll see.
Mr. Chair, I did talk to somebody in the hallway yesterday related to local governments. I don't know if they're here to express some concern.
They're on the list. Senator Gzalka, did you ask for a fiscal note on this? Have you seen a fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, the effective date is 2016, so there, at least in the first 2 years, there was not a fiscal note or a fiscal dollar amount.
Was this? Is there one in our packet? No, I didn't have one.
You have it now,
Mr. Chair.
Ms. McQuay.
Mr. Chair and members, the revenue estimate on this bill is revenue neutral to the state. There's no impact to the state to the state tax as far as the tax committee is concerned. However, in this will change education aids, so there is an impact to the education budget because education aid is reduced by the amount that they receive from the counties. So when you receive less from the counties, you are actually receiving more from the state. And as Senator Gzalka said, this will not have an impact until fiscal year 18. So a fiscal note has been requested, but it will show zeros as far as we forecast.
Thank you. Mr. Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bo Burns, and I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. I was the local government official, Senator Gzalka mentioned, that stopped him yesterday to talk about this bill. I do just want to raise some concerns with the bill for the committee to consider. First, as I think has just been identified here, this bill will create significant fiscal impacts for both counties and the state. To the question about a fiscal note, there was a virtually identical bill introduced last biennium, and there was a fiscal note prepared on it. The fiscal note estimate at the time showed that this would reduce penalty collections in the state by roughly $8 million annually. About half of that would be lost revenue for counties. The other half, as indicated by Senate Counsel, would be a loss to the state general fund, in that it'd be $4 million lost to school districts, which would be made up for by $4 million in increased state aid to schools. I also think there are some policy issues to consider here for the committee. AMC would encourage the legislature to be extremely cautious about reducing the penalties for failure to pay taxes on time. Doing so puts government in a position of more frequently acting as bankers or the lender of last resort by encouraging taxpayers to carry the tax debt with a government entity rather than getting their money elsewhere. The legislature, and this is, I did my best to figure out when the legislature put in place this dual track penalties, and I think it was, as best I could tell, it was 1974 when the legislature put a distinction between penalties on homesteads and non-homesteads, and I think it's a little unclear as to why the legislature would reconsider that policy now. There is a technical administrative issue with this bill, and this is something I mentioned to Senator Gzalka, and he said he would be willing to, if this bill were to move forward, work with us on correcting it. Without getting too deep into the weeds, as taxes become delinquent, right now the penalties on the first and second half property tax bills end up at the same penalty percentage rate. Under this bill, they'd end up different. And again, I can go through more of the specifics about why that's an administrative headache, but speaking to auditors and treasurer county staff, that is a significant burden and would require significant reprogramming and expenses at the county level.
Senator Est.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I don't understand the impact on education aids. Could we have a simpler explanation so I can understand it.
I'll let Mr. Silva, there was a revenue estimate prepared for last year's bill that mm-hmm. talks about that, and if Ms. McQuay could explain that to us.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll give it another try. When we calculate the general education aid for each district, we go to the schools and say, oh, wait a minute, how much did you get in that count from the counties from these penalties? And that then reduces the state amount that we were going to pay the school district dollar for dollar. And so when you actually make a change to the penalties and you reduce the amount of money that a school district is going to receive from a county, then there we hold the school neutral and we increase the aid.
Okay.
And then I'll just say again that it would be a zero as far as the fiscal years that we are considering here.
So, Mr. Chairman, when property taxpayers are delinquent, it, in a sense, creates a hole for the school district to get the pass-through of the property taxes from the county because they just weren't paid. Do I understand that right or no?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, just the penalty portion. It's just that additional.
Senator Rest, as I was reviewing the fiscal note briefly here, there's a list of items that the county shares revenue with the school districts. There were power line taxes, penalties and late fees, and a number of other things. So
there would be
half
less to
of
share.
That would be an impact on the school district.
I have another question then.
Senator Rest.
What impact... can you separate out the impact of non-homestead portion of that from the commercial industrial? And the reason why I ask that is that it may well be the case that we started this system in 1974, but in 1974 we treated homestead property and non-homestead property quite differently, and we have in recent years, in the last decade, we've tended to treat them much more similarly than 40 years ago. So I feel a little bit more sympathy, sorry, Senator Zelka, with a non-homestead property being in line with homestead property than I do making it the same for commercial industrial property.
Mr. Chair, once the fiscal note is done, or maybe we can review the last year's fiscal note, which the numbers will not be accurate for this year, but it does break out the homes and the non-homestead. But this bill is just changing the non-homestead rate, and so to match the homestead, so any effect of this bill is just on non-homestead.
I thought, Senator Gozalka, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, that you were asking for the same on commercial industrial property, too, penalty rate. Did I understand that wrong?
Senator Gozalka.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, yeah, I believe that would include all non-homestead, which would include commercial.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, too, perspective, too, at least in the Crow Wing County area, if you had a building that was worth around $700,000, you're already going to pay over $20,000 of taxes every year. And so, you know, if you compare that to houses, I mean, it's a substantially bigger jump that you pay. And then if you're going to double a late penalty, you know, even if it's a day late, to double 4% late penalty for 30 minutes is very steep. If you think about, if you're looking at the numbers, you know, it becomes bigger and bigger. And I'm just saying they all ought to be treated the same. I would rather see a late penalty of 2.25 for everyone if we're trying to make it neutral than to penalize non-homestead and commercial that we're already collecting much more taxes from.
Anyone else want to testify on Senate File 441? Any questions by members? Seeing none, thank you, Senator. We'll see if we can figure something out here. Senate File number 441 is laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Herr.
Good morning, Mr. Chair
Welcome
and members.
To the Tax Committee, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you Senate File 633. This is a This is a bill on behalf of City of St. Paul, and it composed of four main items. The first item is to extend the city half-cent sales tax to 2047. The current sales tax is gauged to sunset in 2030. This extension is comparable to what City of Minneapolis did during the 2012 session. And number two, the city is asking to continue to use the STAR fund of $3.5 million to pay principal and bonds for capital project beyond December 31st of 2014. The third item, the city is asking to use 40% portion of the city half-cent sales tax for economic development purpose if the amount necessary to meet obligation at the River Center is less than 40%. And the fourth item, the city is requesting that the St. Paul Regional Ballpark property tax be exempt. This is consistent with the Viking and the Twin Stadium. Furthermore, the regional ballpark is a City of St. Paul Park and would normally be exempt from property tax. And so I have here Ms. Sarah Erison from City of St. Paul to help me provide or answer more questions, if you may have.
Ms. Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sarah Erickson. I work for the City of St. Paul. Senator Fong Hur just kind of explained our bill. I don't know if you'd like me to go into more detail, Mr. Chair, or I can stand for questions.
Well, Ms. Erickson, on page 2, lines 22 through 28, you're asking for the ability to use these funds for any economic development purpose. But isn't that already covered up in lines 2.18? It seems to me that it's redundant.
Senator Skoy, lines 2.2 to 2.8 address the 40% of the city's sales tax, that we specifically use to pay debt service on the River Center. That's in law statutorily that we have to use that 40%. Last year in the Vikings bill, the City of St. Paul received $2.7 million to help pay the debt service on the River Center. In 2015, what we'd like to do is use that $2.7 million that was granted last year to refinance the bonds on the River Center, which will free up the city's downtown sales tax, and we'd like to use those proceeds for economic development. So lines 2.2 to 2.28 speak specifically to the 40% of the city's sales tax that we use for debt service. The lines above that speak to the 60% of the city's sales tax that we use for our STAR programs, 50% for Neighborhood STAR and 10% for Cultural. So they deal with our sales tax, but it's two different parts of the city's sales tax.
And so, Ms. Erickson, if we don't make this language change, where would those dollars go if you're not able to use the portion over and above what you need for your bond payments?
Mr. Chair, by law, we have to use them for bond payments, so I think the city would be in a – I guess I don't have a good answer for that. We have intentions to refinance those bonds, so we'd have to go back to the drawing board, I guess, is the answer.
Ms. Erickson, would you just pay the bonds off earlier?
Potentially. Mr. Chair.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would feel more comfortable with this if there were specific projects that or a narrowing of the purposes for which they wanted to use this freed up money rather than just any economic development. That makes me a little bit nervous for the length of time that they're asking for this extension to exist is 34 years. I mean, that's longer than 20-year bonds. Senator Hur, I think it needs to be tightened up a bit myself, Senator, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest, I would agree with that. And as long as you brought up the extension, can the city address why they need at this point to extend another 17 years or 17 years from 2030 as it is? Ms. Erickson.
Senator Skoy, it's 2013. Our sales tax right now is set to expire in 2030, which is only 17 years. And what we'd like to do, if we are allowed the flexibility with our sales tax, is likely bond against that. And we'd likely look at 20-year bonds. So the year 2047 was chosen just to stay consistent with what Minneapolis did last year. But we needed to get over that threshold so we could bond for 20 years.
Ms. Erickson, was the reason that you're bringing up Minneapolis because they used the money for a stadium?
Mr. Chair, the reason that I'm bringing up Minneapolis is we wanted to stay consistent. We wanted to be able to use our own resources for economic development, which is consistent with what they did last year.
Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Herr, I guess I just want to agree with Senator Rest and yourself that no need to mention this as a touchy subject, but we're already subsidizing St. Paul for 2.7, and you're getting a ballpark from Deed. Citizens of the state are picking up that tab. Congratulations to St. Paul. So I could be persuaded to support this if we narrow the terms and keep this a little more focused and a little more on the level for the taxpayers of the city and for the state. So I'd be in line with Senator Rest and Senator Skoy on this. Thank you.
Senator Thompson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I had raised my hand to say the same thing. I think Senator Rest's concern is legitimate, and obviously all of us have different viewpoints on taxation. But, you know, and I don't, this is a highly charged term. I don't mean it to be, but basically what you're looking for is a slush fund, a pot of money with very little direction. And I don't think that's right. I think as much as, again, we differ on taxes and how much money ought to be spent, I think everybody agrees that there needs to be some narrowing so that the taxpayers know where the money may and may not be used. I could potentially see something like this working, but not with that broad a scope.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the comments about narrowing the scope and the fact that this proposal goes out to 2047. I'm concerned about the length of time and really kind of the open-endedness of what the funds could be used for. And those issues have been addressed. But the thing that I was looking for, because of my experience with the Rochester local option sales tax, and of course that always goes to the voters for an extension. It doesn't automatically happen. The city has to make its case to the voters that they're doing a good job and what they're planning to do with the money is something that's in the voters' best interest. And so they always bring that back to the voters for an extension. And I'm looking here and I don't see anything about about a referendum. I just see that, if I understand the bill correctly, it's just extending the tax to 2047, but it doesn't give the voters an option to weigh in. Or am I missing something? Where do the voters get to weigh in on this proposal? Is there a referendum?
Ms. Erickson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, no, there is not. Senate Counsel can probably correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the legislature granted the city of St. Paul the authority to have a sales tax when we first enacted it, and what it required was a vote of our council and the mayor to sign off on that. I believe is the authority. We did not have to go to a referendum originally, but I could be wrong with that.
Ms. Pollock.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, the St. Paul local sales tax was originally adopted in 1993, and the provisions in 297A.99, which require a referendum, apply only to those after 1997, so they're kind of grandfathered in pre-code.
Senator Nelson.
So even though this is well after 1997 and we're talking about an extension, there's no need for an extension. So the grandfathering applies to extensions ongoing forever then for those sales taxes that were enacted before 97.
Ms. Pollock?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, yes, pending approval by the legislature.
So the, Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson.
Just to clarify, so the legislature, as is today, would need to approve the extension
But it doesn't need the voters' approval in the local community.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, that's correct.
Senator Rusk.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Herb, we're not really beating up on your bill, but
no.
we really want to understand it, and so I'm going to go to another subject, and that is the property tax exemption. I note in the revenue estimate that starting in FY 2017, if we granted the property tax exemption or the ability of the city to not have it property tax exempt, that would be an $80,000 increase on other properties in the an $80,000 increase in the property tax refunds, because the property tax that would have otherwise been paid by the ballpark will have to be borne by other property taxpayers. And I wonder just what your thinking was on that, and why you think that would be a good deal for the people who are paying the property taxes and the extra $80,000 that we would be paying out to residents of St. Paul in order to subsidize the property tax exemption for the ballpark.
I'll defer that.
Or Ms. Erickson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rust, thank you for the question. Right now, where the ballpark will be built is an old, I won't say abandoned, it's owned, but there's nothing in a cold storage site in Lower Town. And what we are hoping is that once we tear that down, we build a ballpark, the overall economic development and taxes that the city and the state would garner from that, whether it's from people coming down, enjoying beverages or food or purchasing merchandise there, would more than compensate for that. And one of the great things about this project, that the St. Paul Port Authority was a partner with the city on this, and they actually were the ones that came in and bought the site. And we will then literally swap sites with the Port Authority, giving them the current Midway site, which is in the middle of an industrial park. We're hoping that once the new site is built and it's up and running, that the St. Paul Port Authority will, I think, probably demolish the ballpark and hopefully use it for a much higher purpose, some kind of manufacturing economic development, which, again, would compensate, hopefully, for this $80,000.
Mr. Erickson, unfortunately, the department doesn't let us do dynamic scoring, as you know. Do the Saints pay property taxes on the Midway property right now? And if the Port Authority takes that land over, are they going to put it in a tax increment financing district so that we wouldn't be getting that? There would be no property taxes paid generally to the city, but just kept back and segregated into a TIF district. Do you know their plans?
Ms. Erickson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rust, I'm sorry, I can't speak to the Port Authority's intention with that land, so I don't know. Currently, the Saints do not pay property tax. It is considered a city park, so would be tax exempt. The reason that we're specifically asking for this, Mr. Chair and Senator Rust, is it's likely that the St. Paul Saints will have some kind of store where they sell T-shirts or baseballs on site, and so there was a mild amount of concern about having some kind of private use on the mm-hmm. site, which is a city park. So that was the purpose for this request.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Rust.
It makes me feel better, actually, in terms of the comparison. If you know, they're not paying it now, but if they have a business there, just like any charitable organization that's not related to their tax-exempt purpose, they have to pay taxes on it. Coffee shops and hospitals, things like that. But that's important information that the in terms of apples to apples, that they're not paying property taxes now on a property that's a city park. I don't know that the city can determine that the Lower Town site is a city park, but that makes a difference to me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And along that line, just so I understand, Ms. Erickson, so on page 3, line 25 and 26, where they're talking about real property that is leased residential, business, or commercial development, those developments would pay property tax, but the stadium would not, just so I'm clear on that?
Mr. Chair, I believe the intention of that language is if, for some reason, the site's not extremely large, but if you could put a restaurant or if you there was a hotel or something very adjacent to it, that it's clear that that would be paying property taxes.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. Any other questions, members? I think a little.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Erickson, I've been paying attention, not commenting a lot, and I agree with a lot of the comments have been made. That the last point, though, I did have a question. If there are properties in the ballpark that are restaurants or whatever, I mean, obviously this isn't the same sort of scale as in Minneapolis, but snack bar, things like that, are those property tax exempt too? It's the same as in Minneapolis. I have a problem with that, but again, we've set the precedent. I understand that.
Ms. Erickson.
Senator Scoy and Senator Marty, insofar as that the Midway Stadium that we currently have has kiosks and sells hot dogs and pop, et cetera, yes, it is encompassed within the ballpark and it is property tax exempt. Currently, to my knowledge, I don't know that we have any intention to put a full-blown restaurant or anything in the new regional ballpark. We're in the very early stages of design, so I can't speak to 100% accuracy of that, but I do understand where your concern is.
Senator Martin.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Erickson, and if they are selling hot dogs, whatever, they are paying sales tax on it there. That is different from Minneapolis, but I think.
Ms. Erickson.
Senator Scoy and Senator Marty, yes, I believe that they're paying sales tax on the food design.
Thank you. Anything else, members? Anybody in the audience want to testify on Senate File 633? Seeing none. Senator Herr, I think we're going to need a little tightening on some of these provisions and really rationale on the extension.
Sure.
Going to need some reasonings behind those things. So we'll lay Senate File 633 over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Thank Chair, you. Members.
And Senator Saxhog and Senator Rood have bills dealing with the fiscal disparities program on the Iron Range. I think we'll do both of those at the same time, if that's okay with Senator Rood, Senator Saxhog. I see you have the same testifier. So Senate File 1162, Senator Saxhog, Senate File 1268, Senator Rood, Senator Saxhog wants a study, Senator Rood wants to eliminate. I think we'll let Senator Rood go first.
There you go. Ladies first, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rood, welcome to the Tax Committee, Senate File 1268.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. 1268 asks to repeal the Iron Range Fiscal Disparities Program. I think you all have packages at the table with information. I have here with me today Jeff Walker from Itasca County.
Mr. Walker.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Would you like me to begin?
Sure. State your name for the tape. And
yes, Mr. Chair, my name is Jeff Walker. I'm the Itasca County Auditor-Treasurer. And Itasca County is one of the seven counties located within the Taconite tax relief area. We are also the largest net contributor into the pool of the seven counties. Itasca County contributes about $2.5 million a year now. That's our net contribution. Today I would ask the committee to consider Senate File 1268 calling for a repeal of the Iron Range Fiscal Disparities Act. And from my standpoint, Mr. Chair, the Taconite Tax Relief Area. I'm very familiar with this, by the way. I was a mayor of a small town, city of Cohasset, when this was passed. I was also a local property, commercial tax payer, and so I had standing in court, so I was part of the original lawsuit that was brought forward challenging the act, constitutionality of the act, and just a little history. We won that case in district court. Our district court judge, a local boy from City of Chisholm, who understood the local politics, ruled in our favor. It was reversed on appeal, and the Supreme Court upheld the appellate court. So that's the history of the court challenge of Iron Range fiscal disparities. And now we have to deal with the reality of it. The reality of it is very oppressive to the commercial taxpayers in those areas that are net contributors, such as the city of Grand Rapids. And I say it's oppressive because the area-wide fiscal disparity tax rate is so much higher than the local tax rates in those areas, such as Grand Rapids and Cohasset. For example, Cohasset's local tax rate is 0.91. That's what the taxpayers in Cohasset pay. The area-wide fiscal disparity tax rate that they pay on that portion of their property that's subject to fiscal disparities is 1.7. So it's almost double the tax rate that they would pay without fiscal disparities. So the local property tax rate is 0.91. The fiscal disparities tax rate is 1.7. And that's why I say I feel it's very oppressive. The other thing is I believe that good tax law is something that's transparent and predictable, and can be controlled by local taxing authorities. Fiscal disparities, the local taxing authorities have absolutely no control over that tax rate. It's completely out of their hands, even though their constituents pay it. It's calculated by formula and not by city council, not by county board action. It's unpredictable and extremely volatile. As you can see, 2012 fiscal disparity rate was 1.4. The 2013 fiscal disparity rate is 1.7. And that's about a 21% increase from one year to the next. So it's very unpredictable, very volatile, and that makes it extremely difficult for business owners to handle and to budget for. I guess without going into too much more detail, Mr. Chair, I'll just leave it at that and say that I've been opposed to this idea of fiscal disparities on the range for 15 to 18 years. And I would ask the committee here to strongly consider repealing this in the interest of all the small business owners.
And Mr. Walker, can you talk a little bit about the interaction of the other distributions that occur because of the production tax? I mean, there are other. This is not the only mechanism for impacting property taxes on the range. So, can you talk a little bit about some of the other efforts and how this interacts with that?
Are you speaking specifically of the taconite taxes?
Taconite taxes, yes.
Okay. Well, the taconite taxes, the taconite tax relief area is defined by school district. So it was defined early on, I believe, to provide relief and another funding mechanism for the local school districts in the taconite tax relief area. And back in the 40s and 50s, I guess, when this was all developed, set up, I think there are probably mines on all three Iron Ranges, the Vermilion, the Cuyuna, and the Mesabi. And now, of course, the only active ranges or mining operations are on the Mesabi Range. And it's really not a very big area when you look at it. It only comprises an area about a mile wide and maybe 30, 40 miles long. So for years, those taconite taxes are collected as a royalty on the taconite production. And they are paid, and the law says they are paid in lieu of ad valorem tax or local property taxes. So it's been, I think, the contention of a lot of people in those areas that have active mines that they've been sharing their local property taxes with areas that no longer have active mines. And that was, I think, one of the was part of the rationale for passing this law, was to recoup some of those local property taxes, and to make up for those taconite dollars that have gone to other areas, to now share the property taxes that have been brought about by the development that's come from sharing of taconite dollars. I don't adhere to that. I think that the taconite tax is a tax it's a royalty tax on a state resource. The fact that it replaces some local property taxes is, that part is debatable, I guess.
Well, Mr. Walker, isn't part of the 0.9 rate on the local property tax a result of the taconite tax that's redistributed around to the areas that no longer have active mines, but historically were in the taconite distribution area?
Well, that particular rate, 0.9, Senator Descoy, I don't think that would be affected by taconite taxes. Cohasset doesn't get much taconite tax at all. Some of the homeowners may get taconite credit on their tax. It would be very minimal. I don't have that number available, but it wouldn't be very much money.
Senator Artman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Walker, thank you for your testimony. You have a very complicated job. I'm wondering if either the taconite taxes or the fiscal disparities are taken into consideration into our local government aid formula.
Mr. Walker or staff?
No, they're not.
Mr. Walker,
Senator
Scoy,
members, the city of Cohasset does not receive when I was on the city council, we did not receive local government aid. Is that what you're referring to? Or
maybe the question isn't for you. Maybe the question is for Senate Council.
Okay, it's probably above my pay.
Senator Artman.
We can do some research to get back on that, I hope. It's my understanding that it's not. And so I think what we're doing is shifting a lot of property tax wealth in tiers, starting with the taconite taxes, adding on the fiscal disparities, and then also using a local government aid that is benefiting some communities in an extreme way, and then hurting other communities in a very extreme way. And so when you pile all those government programs or shifts or formulas on top of each other, they're having a very big impact. And so then the question becomes, how do you simplify what has become a very complicated set of programs designed to help certain communities that may need some help, but maybe we've just gone too far? Is it that you eliminate fiscal disparities? Is that the smartest way to simplify? Or is it to go back and reformulate the local government aid if those things aren't being factored in? Or is it simply to go back and look at that taconite tax? And I think we looked at that last year or the year before. The fiscal disparities, in my mind, makes a lot of sense. To look at that one as the one that we should be eliminating. And the reason I think so is because it's a terrible economic development disincentive for a community when they know they have to, in order to bring in a new business, they're going to lose a lot of that property tax income to some other community. So what's the point in bringing in these other businesses if the benefit that that brings to the community goes to some other community? And then what's the incentive for the community that's a winner on the fiscal disparity, if you will, if they get that money in and the shift of the property tax wealth, what is their real incentive to go and recruit new businesses into the community? As long as our neighboring city does it, we're fine. And so I think we've got some real problems in the whole system. And we need to go back and look at what we've done. We've built all kinds of complexity, all kinds of strange disincentives and incentives for action that we don't really want to encourage. So there's work to be done here. I do think it would help. It's my understanding, Mr. Chair, that we do not factor in the taconite taxes into the LGA, but I'm still wondering about the fiscal disparities.
Mr. Silva.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, you are correct. The production tax is not factored into the LGA formula, but the contribution distribution of the fiscal disparities is factored into the LGA formula for purposes of revenue.
Well, and
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Silva, do you know if the governor's proposal with LGA changes would include any of these programs one way or the other, address any of this?
Mr. Silva.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, I don't believe that the governor's proposed changes, including an increased appropriation, would necessarily change the relationship between fiscal disparities or the production tax.
Thank you.
Well, Senator Saxog, your study's looking better.
It is.
Did you have anything you wanted to say, Senator Saxog?
Well, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. 1162 is a bill that requires the Department of Revenue to conduct a study relating to fiscal disparities in the taconite relief area. And I would probably ultimately agree with Mr. Walker on Senator Rood's bill that the final solution may indeed be elimination of the fiscal disparities law for the taconite relief area. There was some better reasons for having fiscal disparity in the taconite relief area 15 years ago, but quoting Mr. Walker, and I think he's correct, it's become unpredictable and volatile, and so I think this would be an opportune time to do a study. The Department of Revenue has indicated that they can absorb the cost, and so that would be the gist of my bill.
So, Senator Saxog, are you telling me that the appropriation language on...
I don't think you should take that over.
I think you're going to better hold up on the appropriation language, Senator Saxog, and see what's going to happen with that. But, Senator Nelson, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just a more general question to help me understand this better. What is the total maybe for this year or last year, just to get an idea of the scope that we're talking about here? What was the total taconite tax or production tax, and what is the total fiscal disparities tax for the most recent years? Do we have that in our packets?
I think Senator Rood has handed some of this out.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, I think if you look at this piece, it does have all the 2013 fiscal disparity numbers on it.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, do we have those numbers then for the taconite tax as well?
Well, we wouldn't have that with this discussion because it just came up today.
Mr. Chair, could we get that for the committee? Future?
Senator Nelson, I'm sure that if you... Department can get the production tax totals for you.
And Mr. Chair, I think that is part of the goal of my study is to discover those particular figures that you speak of, Senator Nelson, and put them in perspective, and have the Department of Revenue do it so we have a neutral source of the kind of the analysis and go from there.
Senator Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I
Recall a couple of years ago, we did a study of the metropolitan tax base sharing, and we did have an appropriation for that. So I would not encourage you at this point to take the appropriation off. I think the study that was commissioned, that the department was able to contract with someone to do that. And I think the appropriation was $100,000, if I'm not mistaken. And I think we should not, maybe not fill it in now, but I would be reluctant to just ask the department to absorb it. And furthermore, I think the Iron Range Fiscal Disparities was a project of Senator Johnson when he was the tax chair, he was very insistent upon it, as I recall, and because he liked the way in which the impacts were felt are seen in the metropolitan area. I would be very concerned about if we just repealed it in, you know, right away, that the we see that there would be increases on homestead property by over $2 million, according to the revenue estimate, and there would be impact increases in the property tax refunds far more significant than the St. Paul project. So I think we should be very cautious about moving forward with just an absolute repeal right off the bat, and we can always, a label is sometimes too descriptive, and to talk about the columns of winners and losers as opposed to net contributors, it's not that they don't get anything, and the idea of the tax-based sharing programs are that in many instances, some communities are much better situated. Maybe they're on, highly traveled highways or whatever in an area, and businesses are naturally drawn to them because of that. And other communities have a poor tax base, not because they don't want people to come to their communities and develop businesses, but for a number of reasons, they're just not able to. And I think that that's the whole idea, is that of the tax base sharing in any area, is that the the rising tide lifts all ships, and it's a regional economic development notion, not just my city versus your city. And I think the study approach at this point would give us and the range legislators would give them and us and the communities a much broader view of whether this is something that should be maintained, changed. Maybe we could put in the study recommendation, ask the department for recommendations for improving it to deal with volatility and unpredictability, and to and make other kinds of recommendations that doesn't hit homeowners with a sledgehammer all in one fell swoop, and the state for property tax refunds. And it may be that it's not a program that's appropriate for the Iron Range, and we should help them in phasing it out or understand exactly what happens if we eliminate it. But I would be very reluctant to do it in just one fell swoop, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Saxon.
And Senator Rest, I agree with your description of fiscal disparity as an original program, and that was the purpose. And I think the three of us sitting at this table, as you say, understand that it has become unpredictable and volatile, and at least a study would be in order. And Mr. Chair, I certainly take yours and Senator Ress's advice on appropriation, and would like to lay 1162 at least over for possible inclusion.
Okay. Senator Artman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to correct myself on my terminology. I went to a town hall last year in somebody else's district, and I was trying to, somebody asked me about fiscal disparities, and I talked about winners and losers, and one of the guys got really offended at my calling his community a loser.
Exactly.
Got to be careful, right, just saying. But Senator Saxhog, I'm concerned about the dates in your bill. I think we can do that study and should do that study sooner, and I'm not sure why we would wait until January 1, 2014 to get started. We should make that August 1, 2013. I'm going to make a motion in just a moment. And I think we should get the results back by July 1, 2014, because then we'll have time to bring it back to communities that will be affected. They'll be able to look at it. And then we can come back and actually get something done. If we wait until February, nobody shows up with a bill in mid-February and gets anything done with that bill, at least of this nature. So I would move, and hopefully you would find that to be a friendly amendment, Senator Saxhog.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman.
Senator Saxhog.
Definitely.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, I would move that line 1.8 of Senate File 1162 be changed to take out February 1, 2015 and insert July 1, 2014. And on line 1.23.
July 1,
2014. So that would give them 8 months, 9 months to get this done. I think that's more than sufficient time. And then on line 1.23, change the effective date from January 1, 2014 to August 1, 2013.
How about upon enactment?
Upon enactment is fine, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, I appreciate that, that
Senator,
you understand the sense of urgency that there is in that, you know, for Aiken County, they have a population of 16,000 people, and this has become a big burden for them. And so I appreciate your understanding that sense of urgency in this to get this study done.
Thank you. Senator Ortman moves the following oral amendment on page 1, line 8, strike February, insert July, strike 2015, insert 2014. On page 1, line 23, strike January 1st, 2014, and insert upon enactment. Any questions, members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rood, I was looking at your handout here. Could you clarify something here for me? And when I thumb through this, there's four columns, and it's by county. It goes city, township, and then by county. And then you have totals by county for 4 years. Is that correct? So if I look on page, what would be page 3, total St. Louis County, $9.3 million. Is that $9.3 million they receive to the positive? Is that correct?
Mr. Walker?
Mr. Chair and Senator Chamberlain, that is correct. I will state for the record that St. Louis County is the only net, I'll use the word
gainer.
Winner.
Gainer.
Madam
Senator Chamberlain.
Gainer. Mr. Chair. So, yeah, that to follow up on that, so of all these counties, St. Louis County is a net gainer by $9.3 million, and all the other counties are paying into that. Is that correct? Or they're all net
Mr.
of
Chair,
gainers we're seeing?
Mr. Walker.
Chamberlain, the only exception would be Couchiching County, which is almost a non-factor. I think there's only 30 parcels in the Taconite tax area, so it's almost a non-factor. But definitely five of the seven are net contributors. One is a net recipient.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the study is timely, Senator Saxog. Thank you.
And Mr. Walker, which county is that 30-mile by 1-mile strip of active mine in?
Actually, Mr. Chair, it begins now. The active mines begin just outside of Grand Rapids with the introduction of magnetation, which is a new mining process. They pay in a taconite. They pay taconite royalties. So it begins outside of Bovee.
Yeah.
And extends over to into Hibbing. So St. Louis and Itasca County are definitely active mining areas.
Mr. Chair, I would describe it as two-thirds in St. Louis and one-third in Itasca, the way things are.
Yeah, the way things are right now, of course, we have SR Steel developing.
Walker.
They'll begin production, taconite production, and paying in. So those numbers will change.
Thank you. Anything else, members?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson.
I just have one question maybe for the testifiers. The study, I'm reading here what it looks at, and it particularly it's just about the fiscal disparities. And would it be, I don't know, would it be a good thing to also include the taconite production tax in that study? I'm thinking I'd want to know how does that impact tax variability and the program's impact on homestead property tax burdens, or is would you see that as needed in a different study?
Sure. And Senator Nelson, I was just looking at the language of the bill here. It does include description of other property tax aid and local development programs. So I wonder if it isn't already included in the proposed study. But Senator Saxog, what would you be your intent there?
Well, my Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, my intention wasn't necessarily to study anything in particular, but if that's the way we describe it in the bill, you know, that would be it's fiscal disparity that's appropriate here, I think.
Okay, thank you. Okay, seeing nothing else, we will lay over Senate File 1268 for possible inclusion. And we will lay over Senate File 1162 as amended for possible inclusion. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair,
thank you.
Members.
Thank you, Member.
Thank you.
I want to do the Senate report first.
Going to start with 492.
Yeah.
Senator Skoy brings us Senate File 492, and I understand there's an A2 amendment. Is that correct? I wonder, has that been distributed? If not, let's do that while he's coming to the table. We have the A2 amendment before us. Senator Skoy moves the A2 amendment, author's amendment.
Madam,
did you have a change?
I also have an A1 amendment, but I'll hold on that. Let's do the A2 amendment.
A2 amendment. Senator Skoy moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Say no. The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Skoy, you now have Senate File 492 is amended before us. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And members, this is the Sustainable Forestry Initiative Act. And as many of you know, there's a history behind this initiative. This program has been around for a while. A number of years ago, there was a formula added to the calculation for determining the per acre payment. When we made the changes in the rural vacant land and woodlands and ag land classifications, there was an impact on our formula that caused the formula to almost double per acre payments. We were also in the middle of deficit discussions at that point in time, and there were caps put on these at one point. There were reductions in payments at one point, and also the elimination of the program for the large landowners. At that time, a number of those large landowners then left the program. So we are now to the point where we need to figure out what we're going to do with regard to the Sustainable Forest Initiative program. We need to figure out what the per acre payment would be best, what the dollar amount should be, and also we need to figure out how we're going to re-enroll these large number of acres that were on a roll, were taken out of the program as the payments to them were eliminated. So they were able to get out of the program without penalty. They had their easements were removed, and they I think we should figure out a mechanism for reinstating them into the SFI program if they would like to. But I do have some folks that want to testify on the Sustainable Forestry Initiative Act, and so I think if it's okay, Madam Chair, perhaps we'd bring the folks forward that want to
testify. Sure, welcome the testifiers as they're coming forward to have a question. Senator Skoy, is the proposal continues $7 an acre up to 920 acres, and then if you have more than that, the total number is at $5, or is it a second tier so that the number of acres in addition to the over the 1920, they it's $5 on those, but $7 for those under that. Is that do I get that right or not?
Madam Chair, and this is a number that's part of our ongoing discussion, but the way this bill is in front of us today, those acres that are under 1,920 acres would receive $7. Any landowner who owns more than $1,920 would receive $5 on all the acres. And this is an area that is needing some continual work, but I wanted to have dollars to put in there rather than blanks. So
it's not tiers. It's like if you had 2,000 acres, you'd get $5 an acre on the whole 2,000. If you had less than 1920 or 1920 and less, you'd get $7 on that amount.
And Madam Chair, I think the way I'm reading this, it says with a claimant with no more than 1920, they get one level. And then for a claimant with more, they get another level, the $5.
On the whole amount, not $7 on the first 1920 and then $5 on a number. Okay, just want to make sure I understand that. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Wayne Brandt, Executive Vice President, Minnesota Forest Industries, Minnesota Timber Producers Association. Our members are loggers, sawmills, truckers, allied businesses for the timber producers, for Minnesota Forest Industries, primary manufacturers, paper mills, large sawmills, engineered wood products manufacturers, utility pole manufacturers, producers of electricity from forest biomass, and forest landowners. Thank you for the opportunity. I want to thank Senator Skoy for bringing this bill forward. There have been, just a quick bit of history, there have been various programs dealing with forest land taxation through the history of our state to encourage conservation, to keep those lands forested, to make sure they're reforested after harvest, and to produce wood to support the forest-based economy and the jobs. The SFIA program that we're talking about today was enacted, I think, 11 or 12 years ago. It replaced the tree growth tax law, which over a period of time had become antiquated and really wasn't targeted at the modern needs. There also were auxiliary forest tax laws and, frankly, other provisions going all the way back to the adoption of our state's constitution dealing with forest land taxation. You know, we think that there are several things Senator Skoy mentioned. A couple of them, you know, we would certainly like to see language if this is adopted that would allow for the re-enrollment of lands that were removed from the program when the $100,000 cap was put in place. Relative to the formula that Senator Skoy mentioned, you know, we would hope that the committee and staff and the Department of Revenue would take a look at the original formula construction when the law was passed, which was a more moderate approach than occurred after the amendment three or four years ago that caused the payments to double in a rapid period of time. That was not our proposal in that amendment, and we certainly understand the concern and the problems that that caused. So maybe taking a look at the statute's original formula might make some sense in this area for all of the lands. You know, we think that also the committee ought to consider a provision that would allow for the covenants to be extinguished in the future and lands to leave the program if the payments for some reason are not made, if they were to be capped again, or if funds were not to be appropriated. If that isn't done, landowners with these covenants, and when you enroll, you sign up for 8 years initially, and you have a four-year notice provision to withdraw your land. So landowners can be put in the position of having a covenant on their lands to perform for the state and maybe not getting the payments that they had signed up for. We obviously support removing the cap and think that that's important. In the general area of forest land taxation, the Minnesota Forest Resources Council conducted a study as directed by the legislature. I believe that that study was provided by the Forest Resources Council to the committee. I believe that staff and Dr. Hibbard from the Forest Resources Council, who performed that work, is here. And I think he's met with certainly the chairman and maybe some of the rest of you. In terms of other provisions and other things that folks might be looking for, I would just caution the committee to not make this program overly complicated for landowners, particularly for small landowners. I mean, my people have staff to deal with these things, but making it overly complicated for landowners doesn't seem to make a lot of sense for small people. We also would caution the committee about getting the DNR too deep into performing administrative functions and reviews. The Division of Forestry's staff has been substantially reduced by about 25% over the last 4 or 5 years, 100 fewer FTEs in there. So we would caution against too much paperwork burdens for the department or for the small landowners. Thank you.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a question for Mr. Brandt. He mentioned in his testimony that we need to find a mechanism for the people that were removed themselves from the program when the payments weren't made. Currently, the way I and staff were reading this bill is they would be able to reapply and apply for SFIA just as if anybody would. And is that an adequate re-enrollment mechanism, or do we need something over and above that that you would be advocating for?
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, I mean, if in fact that's the case, where those lands were unenrolled under the previous provision, if they could simply apply and be back in, that may be adequate. I'm not sure about the timing and the lags that are there. You know, we'd certainly be interested in visiting about that and understanding that better.
Senator Skoy, what was the impact of the unenrollment on the owners of the acres that were unenrolled? Did they then start paying taxes, or just not receiving these payments, and everything else remained the same?
Madam Chair, there was a part of the law that was they would not receive the payment. So they, as Mr. Brandt said, they had a covenant on their land, right, but they weren't receiving the per-acre payment that they would have been supposed to get under the what the law was when they signed up.
But they were still held to the covenant, is that correct?
Well, and then they were allowed to unenroll because they didn't get the...
Without any penalty.
Without any penalty.
And so re-enrolling would mean another 8-year covenant? Is that...
That would be what I
from the starting point, not going back and saying, well, we were in it for 4 years, so now we're just going to re-enroll for another 4?
That's my thought on it, and if it's an issue with some of the landowners, I'd like to hear about it, but otherwise my expectation would be that this is an ongoing program. I think most of these landowners sign up, and then when their time is up, they re-enroll them again. And so I think that, from my perspective, works. If it doesn't work, I'd like to hear about it. I do think that Mr. Brandt brings up a good point that if for some reason in the future the state does not make those payments to landowners, we need to put a mechanism in place so it's more of a streamlined process for them to get out of the program without penalty.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, my question is why? I mean, why do we want to recruit these owners back into this program? They've made a decision to unenroll. Why should the state now go back, encourage them to enlist again, and give them an incentive of $5 per acre?
Well, and Madam Chair, Senator
Ortman, Skoy,
I'll let Mr. Brandt talk about this also, but part of the effort here is to not have the fragmentation of the forest, and we're encouraging these landowners, small and large, to have sustainable forestry plans in place. It's a benefit to our logging industry to have these folks managing their woods to maximize the quality and the quantity of the trees that are growing on those lands, and then to make sure that we don't have the fragmenting of the forest in northern Minnesota. That would be the rationale from my perspective, and I don't know if Mr. Brandt has anything he wishes to add or not.
Madam Chair,
Mr.
Senator Ortman, I would agree. I think Senator Skoy has very adequately described the program and the reasons. I wouldn't have anything to add.
Senator Ortman and then Senator Dietzick. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's a very good question or a good answer, but of those that decided not to enroll again, did any of them sell their property and fragment the forest?
Well
Senator
Madam
Skoy.
Chair and Senator Ortman, I don't know that they have or have not as of today, but that is the concern, is that they will. And so that is why I think it's important to re-enroll them in the program to assure that we get the benefits that we just talked about.
Senator Skoy, have any of them disallowed public access?
Well, Madam Chair, that's part of our ongoing debate, and I think there was some access that was not allowed.
Cut off.
And as you see, there is some language in the amendment that we adopted that is actually expanding the access somewhat, and I expect that that will bring some discussion as this bill moves through the process.
Senator Dietzick.
Senator Ortman asked my question.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I could ask
Senator Ortman.
One. Why? How did you come up with the $5?
Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, that's a very good question. And the answer that I'm going to give you is because the author of this bill in the House picked 7. And I didn't want to have the same number as the author in the House. I wanted to have some continued discussion, and I picked 5. I could have picked 6. I could have picked 4. Just thought it was a nice number.
Chair, 5 and Senator Skoy, 5 is nice. 3 works better for me. Just
3
saying.
Would be good if you want to make an amendment.
Is there further discussion on Senate File 492? Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate File 492? If so, would you come forward, please?
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Bruce Zumbauen,
past president of the Minnesota Forestry Association, otherwise known as MFA. I currently serve as the chair of the Government Relations Committee, and the SFIA is very important to our members as well as the 2,200 some family woodland owners. We've had a long interest in the development of this program. Our mission today of MFA is to encourage the retention and sustainable management of family-owned woodlands. In the 2011 session, legislative session, we had a proposal to address some issues within the SFIA itself that were reflected in Senate File 842. Those provisions included registration of the management plans that are now required under the 2C Managed Forest Law by the DNR. This is a requirement that the DNR has long sought to make it easier to administer the program, along with the Department of Revenue. The other thing that bill required was a disclosure requirement to new owners on the penalties that run with the covenant if they break them. The other aspect that we addressed was also to increase the penalties. The core of the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act is the covenant. Without protecting that covenant, there's really no reason for the SFIA. The Department of Revenue informed us back then that there was at least six situations where structures and even a home were built on SFIA properties in violation of the covenant. We think that that should not occur. The purpose of the SFIA is to maintain it as working forest, and therefore we recommended some increases in the penalties to reflect that. Regarding the amendment that was just offered, we also have concern about allowing motorized access for fish and wildlife resources on enrolled lands, which is a new situation. I can understand there's motorized recreational interests that would love to have that. But again, the purpose of those working forests is for management of forest lands, and I guess I would raise a concern that that would change the purpose of the law. It is restricted to just larger ownerships, but still someone would say, well, why can't we do it on smaller ownerships too? That concludes my remarks, Madam Chair, and I'll stand
Thank you,
for
Mr.
any questions
Zambalan.
Anybody has.
Is there any questions or comments for Mr. Zambalan? Senator Skoy, would you want to comment on the motorized thing in your language in your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members.
Senator Skoy.
To the testimony with regard to motorized, I understand that this is a work in progress with regard to the access to these larger lands. What my intent is to restrict these to what would be thought of as the logging roads that the loggers would be building to access their jobs, not for these motorized vehicles to be traveling around in the woods without order. So I know I need to work on this language. I appreciate the testimony. I appreciate the concern. I am working on this and trying to come up with some language I think will work for all parties.
So that it's narrowed to a specific purpose.
I'm going
to
narrow it up.
Yeah. Is there any other discussion? Thank you, Mr. Zambalan.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there any other person who wishes to testify on Senate File 492? Then Senator Skoy, have you completed discussion of this bill?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Then we will lay over Senate File 492 as amended. The final bill on the agenda for today is Senate File 1012, which is also Senator Skoy's bill. So I would direct your attention to Senate File 1012. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I have the A1 amendment, which...
Okay, the A1 amendment is being distributed.
Maybe, Madam Chair, while the amendment's being distributed, I could just talk about the original bill and then the amendment.
Please do that. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, the original bill came about as a result of of the large tracts of land that easements, conservation easements, were put on in northern Minnesota. And in the intervening time, those valuations on those properties have dropped significantly. I can't recall exactly the numbers, but I think from a high of $180 million, they were then reduced to $54 million. Then, as a result of a court case, the value was reduced further to $25 million, resulting in a huge shift of property tax burdens onto the other landowners in those areas. So that was my original intent, was to address only those lands that have been purchased with conservation easements, that have been purchased with legacy dollars. In the intervening time since this bill was introduced, I have been having further discussions and ongoing dialogue with many of the assessed or the affected parties and stakeholders, bringing me to draft the A1 amendment, which is just a very simple, makes this bill quite simple, in that if you have a value of real property that a conservation restriction or easement is put on, that the value of that property may not be reduced because of the easement. And so I offer the A1 amendment.
Senator Skoy moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, it's an author's amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Skoy.
And Madam Chair, I think my discussion pretty well covered my points. I see these conservation easements are being applied. I understand the rationale behind that, but my concern is the property tax shift that's occurring in these areas where these conservation easements are going on, shifting the cost of services to those lands onto all the rest of the property taxpayers. I think it's fine for conservation easements to go on, but I still believe that the highest and best use of the land is what it was prior to the easement going on and should be maintained for property taxation. And so I would ask for your support in this effort.
Senator Skoy, nothing in the bill would prevent an assessor from increasing the value. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, no. If there's a thought that the conservation restriction would increase the value, that's allowed to occur. It's just not allowed to be reduced.
Let's see. We'll hear testimony now then, unless there are any questions. Sir, if you would identify yourself, please, for the record. We're happy to have you speak.
Madam Chair, Senators, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for the opportunity of addressing the body here. In July of 2010.
Sir, you need to identify yourself for the
record. I'm sorry,
record.
Kerry Welsh. I apologize.
Mr.
Kerry Welsh, St. Louis County Assessor's Office.
Thank
my
you.
Primary function, or one of my primary functions, is dealing with tax court issues in St. Louis County and now the City of Duluth.
Thank you. Mr. Welsh.
I apologize.
It's okay.
July of 2010, the Lutzard Sam's Fund forwarded $43 million basically to UPM Blandin for the conservation easement that they basically signed off on. Let me preface my statement by saying that nothing that has been done since then by UPM Blandin is not a good business decision on their part, and there's nothing illegal or wrong about it. I believe it's basically a case of unintended consequences, and I hope that you'll agree with this. For pay 2011, that's January 2nd assessment date, 2010 for pay 2011, the conservation easement was not yet in place, and Blandin presented, or I should say Blandin filed in the Minnesota Tax Court and presented an appraisal of $52 million. $52 million appraisal is based, from their perspective, on a unit approach or an economic unit approach. They're looking at valuing the entire 187,000 acres under the conservation easement as one economic unit. And that basis, the conclusions were based heavily on the income approach, and that's the income to timber production. So that basically is contrary to Minnesota statutes, which call for the assessor to appraise the parcels based on the contiguous ownership. And contiguous ownership, basically, or by parcel, contiguous ownership is the definition of a parcel. Sometimes that's confused with tax parcel, but again, the statute, Minnesota statute definition of parcel is contiguous ownership. So what's gone on is the assessors are going out into the do their assessment work, and they're making comparisons of 40, 60, 120, 600-acre parcels. They're comparing sales of parcels of that size to determine the market value. One of the tenets of assessing is equally located, equally assessed. And Blandin's position in this case has been that it should be assessed as one economic unit, the entire 187,000 acres. The again, that and that particular their particular position on that was rejected in the Marlowe versus Lake County case about a year and a half ago. Subsequent to that, in the conservation easement again took effect on January 2nd of 2011 for taxes payable in 2012. They filed again for 2012. And the appraisal that they submitted was for $25,800,000. That's, again, the 187,000 acres is represents, it's spread out over seven different counties, 83% of which is in Itasca County, 12% which is in St. Louis County. And that's that percentage is the number of acres. I've got just a few figures here on how that basically works out. And for St. Louis County, you've got 22,520 acres for 2010, paid 2012. The current tax value for that year was $17,300,000. The Sewell appraisal, again submitted to the tax court, was for $5,064,068. That's a tax abatement for that particular year of roughly $136,000. For the 11 paid 12, the taxable value was $16,905,300. And the Sewell appraisal, again, with the conservation easement in place, is $2,895,960. Again, that's an abatement of $177,000. We're estimating that if they're successful in St. Louis County, it'll be a reduction of about $175,000 of income, and that's to all units of government within St. Louis County in the future years. Again, our position is that the conservation easement basically allows them to retain rights to carbon credits, rights to wetlands credits. They can also, use it obviously for timber production, but also they have the right to gravel and mineral extraction. Again, our position is that the if you look at what they've done here, we look at it as if they've been prepaid for the loss of future benefits, and it's not unlike somebody remortgaging their house, you know, to invest in other property or leveraging to invest in other property, and basically the laws that are in place right now state that, again, the statute states that we have to assess it as in fee simple, the exception being conservation easements, and the way that's written is we may do that. And I think it's important, one of the important factors in that, of course, is that the loss of or diminution of value is based upon the highest and best use changing. And I think in many cases in the Blandin, with the Blandin properties, I think the highest and best use may or may not have changed. And I can't get into any more, can't give you any more information on that, again, because it is in tax court. But I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Welsh. Senator Skoy?
Madam Chair, I think there's a couple other folks on my list. I don't know if they're still interested in testifying.
Is there anyone else here who is here to testify on this? If you'd please come forward on this bill, pending file 1012, as amended. Welcome to the committee, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Madam Chair, my name is Tom Dibbing, and I'm the Houston County Assessor. And I'm a member of the MAAO Legislative Committee. And I guess our concern with the language is we have a position statement, and I'm sure all of the committee has seen that before, and we want to recognize that that we have to have high quality assessments and a uniform and consistent application of the market value. And the market value is kind of the tenet for how we put values from one year to the next on a property. And in evaluation assignments, opinions of value are based on use. And so when we look at the uses of the property, we look at the highest and best use of the analysis of that property. And our first consideration is it physically possible to do what you'd like to do with the property. And then the second consideration is it legally permissible. And that's where these conservation easements come in. What is the easement? What is the property owner giving up for that benefit of monetary benefit that they're receiving? And so based on the easement, we think that the value should be looked at based on what they gave up. And if they did not give up much of anything, then the value pretty much remains the same. We certainly recognize when these easements come into play in jurisdictions and it's a pretty significant shift in taxes. We understand the issue that goes along with it. But we just want to make sure that you keep in mind our premise on what the market value is on these properties.
You know, I'll call on you, Senator Skoy, but I'm reminded of a case a number of years ago where we had a program where with regard to businesses that polluted their property, and they had to pay for that. I mean, that was taken into account. And then they, because the land was polluted or the property was polluted by their business, they went to, they asked for relief, and they wanted their property value written down to zero. And, you know, they were a responsible party, and then they wanted to not only not pay for the pollution, but they wanted no property taxes assessed, even though it was still an ongoing business. Senator Skoy.
And thank you for that, Madam Chair. That is also good to think about. The other thing I want the committee to think about with regard to this value that's being potentially written down because of the conservation easement, the landowner got paid for that, and that has to be included in this calculation because the landowner is receiving compensation for this restriction. And then he wants to have his value reduced also. And it seems like they're double-dipping on that to me. Now, I know it might be problematic if that land is sold to the next landowner, but I would expect that the price that the next landowner would pay would be reflective of the conservation easement and should be continued. And so I think that if you take into account the amount of money that's transferring when they purchase the easement, you can include the highest and best use value on these parcels, even though the easement might put a restriction on it, because there was dollars that traded hands for that. And I think the committee needs to be contemplating that as we work on this issue.
Any questions for the testifier?
Madam Chair, I think
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Drahman. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Stroman. I'm an assistant director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee here today on this bill. Mostly, I just want to express that we have some questions and concerns about how this bill potentially would affect our Reinvest in Minnesota easement program, which is we are the Board of Water and Soil Resources is the largest easement of our holder of state conservation easements in Minnesota. One of our concerns with the original bill was that we have easements that have multiple funding sources in it. I think the amendment at least addresses the consistency issue. However, we still have a concern about a potential disincentive for landowners to enroll their land in conservation. As members may or may not be aware, we have an enormous amount of CRP acres that are set to expire in Minnesota over the next few years. And so, frankly, we are concerned with finding incentives for people to enroll in conservation programs so that we don't lose those conservation lands. I think certainly we've heard about the Blandon case and some of those large easements. Most of our easements are they're much smaller easements. Our average size easement is between 100 and 150 acres. These tend to be farmers or family lands. And currently, it's at the discretion of the assessor how the conservation easement affects the tax value. And frankly, we don't have a lot of good data on how many of landowners in our easement program have received property tax reductions or how significant those reductions may be. And so, you know, we can't really say how it might affect, but we do have a concern that this could potentially be a disincentive, and we would just appreciate an opportunity to continue a conversation with the author as this bill goes forward.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the comments of the Board of Water Soil Resources, and they view this as a disincentive for enrolling in conservation easements. And in my notes here, I was going to close with this, but I'm going to bring it up right now. Most of the discussion has occurred today around this one example, but this is occurring, as she just testified, all over the state in smaller units. And the cost of these conservation programs, which are benefiting our state's environment, are being borne by the local property taxpayers through this reduction in value. And I don't think that's fair. I think if we're going to put these conservation programs in place that benefit our state's water and our state's air and our state's soil, that the state should be bearing that cost. And if it's reflected in the price they pay, so be it. But I don't think it's fair for the local property taxpayers to bear all of that cost, as they currently are bearing 100% of that cost, because the value gets reduced and those property tax dollars shift on to everybody else in that jurisdiction. So I think we're going to have some discussion about this. I think it's probably broader than just this one instance that's being brought up. It's a large discussion that we're going to have about conservation and conservation easements and who pays for what and where the cost falls.
Senator Dietig.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have kind of two questions here. One comment, going back to that highest and best use, I think that, because my understanding of the one situation is that they just can't develop on this land, and I don't know if that's correct or not, but they did retain mineral rights and logging rights and everything, and some may argue that that is the best value, or the highest value might be in those rights. So I think that is kind of where you have some leeway in difference of opinion. And then to Bowser, how hard would it be to go through and literally look at the 100 to 150 different easements that you have, just to kind of get an idea on some of the smaller parcels, how many have gone in and requested changes, and what were the impact to those local taxpayers? I mean, I think that would be helpful in kind of looking on, just for your average size parcel, how what were the impacts and how many people and what percentage are going in and asking for change.
Madam Chair and Senator Dietzick, I think that would be an interesting exercise to understand really what the property tax impact has been of those smaller easements. We hold nearly 6,000 easements in the state in many, many counties. So it would entail looking at each one of those and working with assessors from each of those counties. So I'm not sure it would be an insignificant undertaking, but one that obviously may help us better understand the issue that we're dealing with.
Well,
Senator Skoy.
I'm sure. Senator Dietzick, let me walk you through an example that my local county assessor called me with when I introduced this bill. And there was a landowner who put a conservation easement on his entire farm. I think it was 280 acres or something like that. He received hundreds of thousands of dollars in payment for that easement, approaching probably 80% of the value of the land for the easement that he was put on. I can't remember all the mechanisms that he utilized, but I would expect that RIM was one of them, maybe CREP. I honestly don't know that. But she was walking me through this example, and she's saying, well, now I can't put the highest and best use on this parcel because the usage had been so restricted. And I said, well, yes, but the owner received all that money. I mean, you have to balance the payment that people received for the easement in the calculation somewhere. And so I think that as just a general policy view, not trying to look at the large forested land parcel up in, you know, by Grand Rapids or any individual farm that has put an easement on it, we should be discussing where the burden should fall for the cost of these easements. And there are costs associated with them, particularly if the land value is being reduced. If the land value is not to be reduced, then the costs will be incorporated in the purchase of the easement. I mean, that's where they will go, because the landowner will be paying higher taxes, and therefore he'll want more money for the easement. So that's going to be the debate and the discussion that we need to try to figure out what we're doing with.
Senator Dietzig.
Thank you. That kind of gave me another question. Because the daily, you know, the year-by-year value of the land may or may not change, but if there's a, you know, difference at the end when they sell the land, is there any way that you could adjust this so that they get, and again, they want the money now, so I'm just thinking out loud, to do it so that they get, they see the difference when it's sold. So if they're, again, I'm kind of thinking out loud and probably this properly.
Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair, Senator Dietzig, that's exactly the question to be asking. And I wonder if the payment that he receives for the easement isn't the reflection in the reduced value when he sells it. And as a landowner, he will decide for himself what he needs for a payment to offset that reduced value at the end.
And Senator Dietzig.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then a follow-up question, and I'm sorry, I forgot your name to the buzzer. Do you have them inventoried? Because we've heard other organizations might not have the best inventory of easements. And so do you have them inventoried so at least you can figure out the time and the start frame to go through those 6,000? Or that's what I'm asking. Do you have them inventoried so you can actually get maybe an estimate of how long that would take, how much staff time it would take, what it would all take, or do you need to go and track down records on all those easements?
Ms. Stroman.
Madam Chair and Senator Dietzig, we do have all of those easements inventoried.
Yes, sir.
Madam Chair, Senator Dietzig, I think one of the issues with the inventory, and I don't know if this applies for all counties, but a lot of counties do not know where these easements are, especially the CRP and RIM contracts. And I believe it's due to Homeland Security. So when we make the call, we do not find that out until we go through our five-year rotation and maybe find out that the farmer has put part of his property into a easement program.
Why is that a Homeland Security issue?
We just can't get them.
Is it a secret?
Apparently. That's the answer that we get. And I know that some counties get it, and a lot of counties aren't able to get it, the information.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, this is spurring more questions to me about this. Aren't these easements all recorded with the county recorder?
Mr. Dibbing.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, the RIM ones are for sure. I'm not sure about the CRP ones. We have been able to get the RIM ones because we do a search on RIM and they pop up for us. And yet we have missed a few of them. But you don't get them all, so to speak.
Senator Skoy.
Well, Madam Chair, would it be possible to put a mechanism in place for the county recorder to be reporting to the county assessor when conservation easements are going on in the county? That seems like doable. To the testifier?
I don't know. Mr. Dibbing?
Madam Chair,
is
Senator
that,
Scully. We do
administratively have, possible?
We do have an agreement that when, if they spot them, you know, obviously at the time they do notify us, but the ones that were in place that were, you know, had been in place for quite a while, we had to do a search on our deed log. So.
And is there further discussion or comments from Mr. Dibbing, Ms. Stroman, or Senator Skoy, members of the committee? Mr. Dibbing?
Madam Chair, I guess the one thing is that when a property sells and the person that's purchasing it is purchasing at a lesser value due to the deed restrictions of the conservation easement, they're the first ones that come to our office and say, look what I paid for it, and this is the value that you have on the property. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones that point out, you know, what that couple of those sticks that they're losing in that bundle of rights.
Senator Skoy.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm being helpful to you. I'll give you some language to point to.
Okay. Yep.
I'm sure they all appreciate it. Further discussion? Then we will lay over Senate File 1012 as amended. Senator Skoy, is there further business before the committee?
No, the only thing, Madam Chair, is if you wanted to announce.
Yeah, on Wednesday and Thursday, the Tax Reform Division will be taking up a number of bills, and that agenda is public. There being no further business before the Tax Committee, we stand adjourned.